This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Thursday, October 24th, 2019. I'm Caleb Brown. Economist Emily Oster argues that there is no single optimal set of child-rearing decisions. In her new book, Crib Sheet, she applies economic thinking to help parents evaluate the available choices for themselves. She shows that many widely held views and official government recommendations for parents are not backed up by evidence. She spoke at the Cato Institute in September.
So I want you to picture this. You have a three-week-old. It's 3 o'clock in the morning. You're sitting in bed and your baby is fallen asleep eating, you know, they're there. And you kind of know if you just sort of edge down a little bit and kind of put them next to you, they'll stay asleep and then they'll sleep and you'll sleep and everybody will feel much better in the morning. But of course you're conflicted. There's this bassinet next to you. You're fairly sure that you're supposed to put them in the bassinet. But you know, if you do that, there is a very good chance that you, that they will wake up. So what do you do? Well, your partner, this is entirely their fault. It was their idea, and you'll discuss it with them later. They're snoring next to you, so they're not available for discussion. And so maybe you take out your phone, and you get on Facebook, and you say, hey, does anybody have any thoughts on co-sleeping? People have thoughts, many thoughts, and you get a lot of conflicting views. On the one hand, you have the people who are like, absolutely, not only is it fine to do that, you should do that, because that is the way people have been sleeping for millions of years. And if you don't do that, your baby will probably not be attached to you, and they may never love you. Also, they might not love anyone else. Then there are the other people who are like, if you do this, your baby will die for sure. Okay, that also... Okay, so those both seem very, very extreme. Question is, you know, within those conflicting views, how are you going to make a decision? And so a lot of people ask me, like, when I think about parenting, I don't necessarily start about thinking about economics. You know, why is economics the right starting point for a parenting book? But I think this kind of conflict is kind of precisely the reason why. Because economics is really a science about decision making and about making decisions based on data, as opposed to some other ways you could make decisions, like just at random or on a whim or what the last person you talked to told you. So when you think about this kind of decision, you know, should you co-sleep or not, how should you make the decision? And I'm really going to argue in the book that you should think about the data, you should confront the data, you should confront the actual risks, and you should think about them in the context of other risks that you may be taking, that these risks are not, they're not unique, and they are not, there is not an extreme, neither of these extreme views that are being espoused in these Facebook groups, neither of them is right. Or is exactly right, and that two different people, as Chelsea said, sort of two different people are going to look at the same data and maybe not come to the same conclusions. And I think once you take that kind of confronting approach and really think about the data, you can make the decision that works for your family. And I think when you do this, this is sort of the key insight, is that that isn't going to be the same decision that is going to work for other people. And I think that's really where the subtitle of the book, More Relaxed Parenting, comes in, that part of what is, seems so stressful about modern parenting, I think for many of us, is the feeling like somehow we are doing it wrong because we are doing it differently from other people, and the constant second guessing that comes with that is itself anxiety provoking. And I think recognizing that, you know, I've made the choice that works for me, it won't be the same choice as everyone else, that in and of itself can be a relaxing thing. So I don't want to talk for too long today because I want to leave a bunch of time for Julie and then for questions. But I wanted to give you a bit of a sense of kind of the work that I try to do in the book around getting through some of the data and helping people think about what data is good and what data is less good. So I want to talk just through one example, which is the topic of breastfeeding, and in particular the question of breast milk. Is it magic? So certainly, if you have been parenting in the modern era, you will not be surprised to hear the claim breast milk is magic. The pressure to breastfeed starts very early. It happens a lot. You get it before you have a baby, happens in the hospital, afterwards. You know, if you breastfeed in public, some people will tell you, you know, put that away, but then other people will stop you and they'll say, oh, it's so great that you're doing this for your baby. Like, that's so, so great. Good job. The best. It's the best start. So good. So good. And so, of course, this is like the pressure that people get for this, I think, is made much more salient by the fact that it can be very hard. So, you know, breastfeeding is not, so for some people, it's great. You just pop it on, the baby is, that's great. But for some of us, this is a really challenging thing. The baby doesn't latch. They don't like to breastfeed. They want to do something else. It hurts. Your nipples are bleeding. You know, this isn't like have a cookie. This is hard. And so you're trying to do this very hard thing and people are telling you, you know, you have to keep doing it because that's the most important thing for your baby. And I think it can be very frustrating and defeating, for many women. So just to be a little bit more concrete about like what are people being told, I pulled this list of benefits of breastfeeding from some different websites. And it was too long for just single lists. So we get a categorical list. So some short-term benefits for the baby in terms of health in a wide range of ways, some long-term benefits for the baby in terms of, for the kid in terms of health, less diabetes, less arthritis, less cancer, meningitis, pneumonia, urinary tract infections, Crohn's disease, obesity, allergies. Of course, they will be smarter, higher IQ, but don't forget about yourself. There's a lot of benefits for you, free birth control. You'll be very thin. Your baby will love you more. You're going to be very rich. No stress, sleeping all the time, better friendships. That's very important to a lot of us. And so on. And then in the final column, of course, we have the methane production from cows. Cows produce methane. So really, there are many reasons to breastfeed. And I don't have time to go through all of these in this talk, but I just want to pull out one and talk a little bit about how we would think about evidence for the claim that breastfeeding raises your kid's IQ. So essentially, this claim comes up all the time, the idea that breast milk will make your kid smarter. And to get a sense of kind of why you might think that, let's just like start with a particular example. So this is a study of like 350 Scandinavian kids from the 1970s. The data is from the 1980s. What they do in this study is they compare the IQ scores for these kids at the age of 5, comparing between kids who are breastfed and kids who are not. Because it's Scandinavia, everybody is breastfed, so the comparison is kids who are breastfed for more than 6 months versus less than 3 months. And what they find is that the kids who are breastfed longer have higher IQ scores, actually quite a lot higher. It's about five IQ points, eight IQ points, which is like, that is a lot of, that's a lot of points. And this is actually a pretty standard kind of result. So there's many, many data sets from many different places where if you look at them, you can see that kids who are breastfed have higher IQs than kids who are not. But if you dig a little bit more into this study or kind of any of the studies on this, what you will see is that the moms who breastfeed are also different from those who don't. They tend to be more educated. They tend to be richer. They tend to be sort of positively selected in other ways. There's a sort of interesting side question about like why are there these gradients with education? So actually, those emerge at least in the U.S. in the 1970s. Breastfeeding reached its kind of lowest point in the early 70s, and then it goes up from the early 70s to the present, and those increases are much larger among more educated women, which is something I think we don't have a great understanding about. But the result is that in the sort of current period, the selection is very much in favor of kind of women with higher socioeconomic status breastfeeding more. So to go back to the study, so the researchers actually, in this example, the Scandinavian data, they actually see some features of the mom. That's how they know they're different. So they see their education, they see some things about their income, and they can do what we'd call adjust for them. So they can run their regressions, run their analyses, controlling for differences in education or income to the extent that they see them. And what they find is that when they put in those controls, when they kind of try to hold constant education or income, their effects are smaller, but they're still there. So they find these sort of much smaller differences in IQ, but still what we call statistically significant. So you might say, okay, great. Well, that sounds like we're done. You control for things. That seems good. You adjust for these differences. So probably these effects are real. But I think the worry, and this comes up all the time, is that those controls may be incomplete, right? So I see like whether the mom went to high school or not, but I don't see everything about her background, everything about her education, everything about other features of her. And if those other features are also related to their kid's IQ and to breastfeeding, we may not be like done adjusting for these differences. So we want to ask the question often, you know, if I control a little bit, if I adjust for some differences, the effect gets smaller. How much smaller would it get if I could adjust for everything? So to see this, we can actually look at another study. So I want to put up a little bit of data. So this study uses a much larger sample. It has about 5,500 kids run in the U.S. And the data set this is drawn from has the same features as this Scandinavian data. So I see kids, I see some measure of their test scores, I see whether they're breastfed or not. But I also see two other things. One is I see an IQ test for mom. So now I can see not only the mom's education and her income and whether she's married, but I can also actually see her measured IQ. I can also see multiple kids in the same household. So I see like some moms who have two or three, who are three kids. And in some cases, one of those kids was breastfed and one of those kids was not. So we can do a larger range of analyses in these data. So we can start with what I'd refer to as the naive comparison. So just comparing kids who are breastfed to kids who are not and looking at differences in their IQ scores. And in this data set, the difference in IQ score is about 4.6 points on this particular test. So that's actually very big. That's a very big effect. It's highly statistically significant. So then we can do what they do in the Scandinavian study as well. We can adjust for demographics. So we can adjust for differences in education and income across moms. And what we find is a much smaller effect, but still actually pretty sizable and significant. So this is about 1.4 IQ points, which, you know, is not, maybe you wouldn't look at this and be like, wow, I'm going to change my whole life for that. But that's the kind of effect that gets people's attention. Then we can add a third control. We can say, okay, now let's adjust for the mom's IQ. So now let's go beyond just the demographics and put in the control for IQ. And now we see the effect, while actually in some specifications still significant, is getting much smaller. It's about a half an IQ point. Okay, but it's still there. And so maybe if you're a person whose goal is to kind of like spend all of your time investing in every possible IQ point your kid can have, maybe you'd still be compelled here. But then we can take our last step and we can actually adjust for what family you're in. So we can actually say, let's compare two kids, same mom, one of them's breastfed and one of them is not. And then you see this number here. It's all the way teeny, you barely see it. It's 0.02. IQ points, okay? So almost, and it's certainly not statistically different from zero. So almost nobody is, you're not doing things for 0.02 IQ points, okay? That's not an important number. So why is this analysis useful? So I think it tells us sort of two things. First, it tells us like there is no effect of breastfeeding on IQ, and this is echoed in other data like this and in other kinds of sort of well-controlled studies that we just simply, the best data does not support an effect of breastfeeding on IQ. But I think what's important here is it also gives us a sense of why some of these other studies do show us an effect, right? So one argument you could have is, well, look, you have two studies. One says an effect, one says no effect. How do I know which one to believe? This study says there's an effect if you do it in the same way as these other studies. It's only because they are able to do better at adjusting for differences across moms that they are able to get to zero. So I think this tells us a little bit about why some of these other studies are flawed in this particular way. So I argue in the book that this study is representative of a bigger literature on this particular question, and in the end that there are a bunch of other links between breastfeeding and various outcomes, which sort of you can do the same kind of analysis too. And so in the end, I put up a sort of updated version of this table, which says that actually, to be clear, there are some benefits of breastfeeding, some things that are definitely supported in the best data. Many of them surround some early life health. So babies who are infants who are breastfed seem to have fewer allergic rashes, fewer gastrointestinal disorders. There are some strong benefits to preterm babies and maybe some benefits for ear infections. Actually, it does seem like there are some long-term benefits for mom in terms of breast cancer reduction. And it is mechanically true that cows produce methane. So that's true. But like relative to the sort of picture that you get from the first graph, This is just much more limited. And so when we tell people things like breast is best, that's true in the sense that it's best, in the sense that it has some benefits. And so I guess if that's what you mean by best, then it is best. But I think it's not best in the way that that's said, like it's best and it's best, the most important thing you could possibly do. And if you don't do it, you have failed as a parent. And I think that this picture gives a different, a more nuanced perhaps approach to how we might convince, like talk to people about the benefits of breastfeeding. It doesn't mean that people shouldn't breastfeed, but I think, and I think it really doesn't mean that they shouldn't be helped if they want to, but I think it also means we should be careful about some of the rhetoric we have around the importance of this in parenting. So the book actually goes through much more than breastfeeding. So I'd spend time talking about co-sleeping and about potty training, about the choice to have a parent stay at home versus work outside the home. And I think in a lot of these cases, if you look out at the way people talk about parenting in the world, you would be sort of forgiven for thinking that there is a right choice and that you just have to look out and find, like, what's the right choice? But I think, in fact, in almost all of these cases, the data is more nuanced. So if you think about something like co-sleeping, where I started this discussion, there are some ways to co-sleep that are safer than others, and so there's clearly some messages that should be sent around if you are going to co-sleep, you should not smoke or drink or sleep with a lot of covers, that there are safer and less safe ways to do this. It is also the case that even if you do it as safely as possible, there are some risks to co-sleeping, but they are small. They are small in comparison to, say, the kinds of risks people are taking getting in cars. So that means that some people are going to look at that data and say, you know, there's absolutely no way I would take this kind of risk. This isn't something that I'm going to do. And there are some people who will look and say, yes, I see that, but this is the thing that works for my family, and it's in the range of the kinds of risks that I'm taking, and I'm going to take all the precautions that I can, but ultimately this is the choice that I'm going to make. And I think those are both reasonable choices and not choices that we should be judging people for making. So I want to close on a sort of final note. So this book is sort of all about kind of approaching your parenting in a very, some people would say high effort way, where you think a lot about the decisions and sort of are quite careful in making choices and read a lot of data. And, you know, on the one hand, it's relaxed, but on the other hand, you know, I think I'm often talking to an audience of people who are kind of spending a lot of time like thinking about all the stuff that they're doing. And of course, I write partly in that way because I myself am a highly neurotic person who does that all the time. So I wanted to end the talk with the way I end the book, which is basically the best parenting advice that I have ever gotten, which is a story about bees. So when my daughter was almost two, we were going on vacation to a location where we had been before, and it has a lot of bees. And it's also somewhat isolated. And so not like very isolated, not like the jungle, but like, you know, it's like a 10-minute drive from a town. And I had gotten one of these things that you get as a parent in your head where like I just got like obsessed with the idea that she was going to be stung by a bee and she had never been stung before and she was going to be allergic. And I just like got it in my head and I couldn't get rid of it, and I was sort of thinking about it. So we come to our well child visit, and I have my usual like Google Doc list of things to ask the doctor about, and this is on there. And so I like start in with, you know, we're going to this place, it's very isolated, there's a lot of bees. Here are some solutions I've come up with. You know, first could we just get an EpiPen, like just in case, or maybe we could just have her tested for this allergy. Like, what, you know, what do you think is the right approach that we should take to my important bee situation that I've got here? And we had this like really wonderful pediatrician, Dr. Lee. And Dr. Lee just sort of, she would always just like, let me talk. And she's like, let me talk. And then I finished, she said, yeah, well, I would just try not to think about that. And of course, like, it was the reason it's such good advice was actually what she could have said was, you know, the first time people get stung by a bee, actually they don't typically have a terrible reaction. So like this, you know, like if she does and she has any, like she could have given me a sort of sciencey answer to this, but I think she sort of understood in the moment, like, just don't think about that. You know, this isn't going to come up. If it comes up, you know, it's not going to be a tragedy. You're going to deal with it in the moment, but you can't approach all of your parenting decisions with this kind of like high intensity that you want to do. And I think for me, that's something I think about a lot when I'm in the moment of something that actually isn't a super important decision. I've somehow gotten myself worked up at it. You know, like, let's just try not, I just try not to, to think about, try not to think about that. So let me stop there.
Emily Oster is author of Crib Sheet, a data-driven guide to better, more relaxed parenting from birth to preschool. Subscribe to the Cato Daily Podcast and follow us on Twitter @CatoPodcast.